From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Alex Smith. Susan Wilson is away this week. On today's show, Kansas's Muslim community hopes to educate neighbors in a new mosque.
That actually is a personal dream of mine, a place which will invite non-Muslims to come and learn about us, just to showcase our religion.
An anchor of Kansas City's gallery scene is closing.
What all of us need to go through is we do all die, and what is really deep inside of us, and how do we listen to that?
Plus, a high school graduate puts the finishing touches on her commencement speech.
In kindergarten, we were asked, what is it that we would like to be? Some answered president, astronaut, and firefighter. In my case, a princess.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Alex Smith. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Kansas is home to thousands of Muslims, but just a handful of mosques. To keep up with the demands of the slowly but steadily growing Muslim population, one of Kansas's largest mosques has been planning a big expansion in Overland Park. This is coming at a time when fears over the spread of fundamentalist Islam have created a sometimes uncomfortable environment for Midwestern Muslims. Alex reports that the new Kansas mosque hopes to quell those fears by educating the public.
Just before sunset prayer service on a weekday evening, young students at the Islamic Center of Johnson County practice memorizing the Quran with volunteer teacher Nurdin Lawal. Like Muslims all over the world have done for centuries, these students practice a couple of hours each day for 1 or 2 years or more, learning the entire book in Arabic, even though most of them don't even speak the language. The memorization is made a little easier with the help of a melody which accompanies each line of the text. The Islamic Center is a busy place. In addition to the Quran classes and prayer services 5 times a day, the small ranch house in southern Overland Park hosts religious classes, weekly services, and community meetings. One of the center's leaders, Arif Ahmad, says the center serves over 300 families. And with new faces showing up all the time, the mosque has run out of space.
On Fridays, which is our prayer day during the afternoon hours, which is almost like the Sunday for the churches, we get full. We have no room for anybody to stand. We're jam-packed on Fridays. In fact, when the days are good, people spill out there.
Ahmad points outside to the patio, where worshippers sometimes have to line up to pray during crowded services. About 3 years ago, the Islamic Center started working to expand beyond the house. Using donations from members, the Islamic Center bought 7 adjacent acres. It's currently undeveloped farmland on the southernmost edge of Overland Park, but Ahmad and the other mosque leaders have big plans for it.
Now, keep in mind that this is a work in progress, so this is not set in stone, but this is the vision, and this is what it will look like.
Walking over to some 3D renderings on the wall, Ahmad proudly shows off his vision for a new mosque. It's a dramatic 2-story building about the size of a small shopping center with a tall minaret. In addition to a prayer room, the new building will have a community center, classrooms, and a gym. But as Ahmad says, the Islamic Center wants the new building to be more than just a piece of brick and mortar.
We look at the new mosque as a place which will attract our youth, which will become the epicenter of families. So when my dad dies, I should not be sitting at home sulking. I should be going to the center, and I should be asking people to pray for my dad. When my son has an achievement in life, I should celebrate it with everybody here at the center. We should be having programs here that should encourage everybody in the community to come. We should have fairs. That's what we are thinking in terms of what is the role that we need to play.
The mosque is growing despite some challenges to Muslims in Kansas. This time last year, the state passed a law that effectively bans the courts from enforcing Islamic law. Supporters say the law protects the state from the spread of radical fundamentalist Islam. Critics, however, call the law anti-Islamic. The law could nullify Islamic-based marriage agreements, wills, and business contracts. Ahmad says in recent years, the Islamic Center has also been fielding a lot of questions from non-Muslims about the religion. He hopes the new center can help educate the public about Islam.
That actually is a personal dream of mine. Once we have the building next door, the building that you're sitting in, I would convert that into a place which will invite non-Muslims to come and learn about us. Just to showcase our religion.
Ahmad admits that mosque members are sometimes subjected to drive-by harassment in the parking lot, but he says the center has mostly had a strong, positive relationship with the greater community and local government. But online, the Islamic Center has been on the receiving end of some not-so-friendly articles. Earlier this year, members discovered their new building plans were the subject of a couple of articles by an anti-Islamic blog. The bloggers call the project a mega mosque and suggest its members are trying to spread fundamentalist Islam. Arif Ahmad considers the accusations ridiculous. He says he doesn't read the blog and he encourages others not to either.
The more you go there, the more you help their cause. So you give them more merit when you respond. We've taken an attitude of taking the high road. Let's put it this way. And I think when you take the high road, things fall in place over a period of time.
The Islamic Center of Johnson County hopes to break ground on the new building in the next few months. Ahmad says the center will be built in stages and that it could be several years before it's completed. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
For a longer conversation about state legislation regarding Sharia in Missouri and Kansas, tune into Central Standard on Tuesday morning and call in with your thoughts. Graduation season is in full swing. Throughout the metro, high school seniors are donning polyester robes and tossing mortarboards, and hundreds of valedictorians and senior speakers are delivering commencement addresses. Earlier this week, Casey Current's Suzanne Hogan caught up with a 16-year-old who is preparing to give the speech at De La Salle, an alternative charter school in Midtown.
Hello, my name is Sandra Perez, and I'm the speech giver of the class of 2013 at De La Salle High School.
Sandra's excited and a little nervous to give the speech she wrote, which was selected out of her graduating class of 52, to be part of the upcoming commencement celebration.
It's a speech that is going to be remembered at least by someone, and I want it to be a speech that could impact at least one person.
The impact is pretty major for the Perez family, seeing as she will be the first of her family to graduate from high school. Originally from Mexico, Sandra came to the United States with her family when she was 7 years old. She learned English in middle school and ended up at Northeast High School originally, but there was too many distractions there for her.
I think I was not being really, paying attention much. I was not getting the grades I needed to get. But I think those mistakes made me realize that, you need education to go somewhere. So I was just like, I don't want this for my life, so I need to start working. So I think without those mistakes, I wouldn't have learned the true value of education and what I need to do to get there.
Sandra transferred to De La Salle, a smaller alternative school that offers, among many things, experiential learning programs like the one Sandra got into, MindDrive, a program that teaches urban students how to build electric cars. She grew strong relationships with her counselors, did cross-country student council. The transition was hard at first, but now she's graduating with a 4.0, a year early. But she still remembers some of the anxiety about walking through the doors the first time.
At first, I wasn't, really thrilled about coming here because I did have my friends over there, so it was starting all over again. But as the years have gone by, I've seen that I've gotten, a lot of opportunities here that I wouldn't have normally gotten over there.
The opportunities on the horizon continue to grow for Sandra as she recently got her driver's permit, which is a big deal to any teen, but perhaps is a little bit more significant for her. She's a beneficiary of the DREAM Act legislation signed last year, which legalizes status of approximately 65,000 undocumented youth and is getting them on the path towards citizenship.
You could say I had a lot of faith that it did come true. And I was just so excited when I got it. So just getting my permit was just like, whoa, I finally got it. So it's crazy because that was something I couldn't get before.
And now we're going to hear the speech that Sandra Perez wrote and will present to her peers, teachers, and family on graduation day.
In kindergarten, we were asked, what is it that we would like to be? Some answered president, astronaut, and firefighter. In my case, a princess. In 10th grade, we were asked again. Some answered police officer, rock star, in my case, Bella, from Twilight. Today, we were asked the same question, and this time, a more serious answer was expected. Well, how about this for an answer? Who knows? I say, who knows, because this is the time in our lives to make mistakes. Not hard, fast decisions. This is the time to catch the wrong train. The time to change our major, one, or even 20 times. We could change our minds over and over again because nothing in life is permanent. So the next time we are asked this question, what do you want to be? We won't have to guess. We will know. We'll know. Because if there is something De La Salle has taught me, is that there is not a limit and that our past will never define our future. The class of 2013 is not just another number. This class will make mistakes. We will make a lot of them. But we won't stop there. We will fight for our dreams and become whatever we want to be. We will be the class who inscribes our mark on the world and whose achievements soar throughout the cosmos. So to all those teachers, parents, counselors, and all those who have supported us, thank you. Without you, we couldn't be here. And to my class, the class of 2013, congratulations. Now it's time to astound the universe with our accomplishments.
That was 2013 De La Salle graduate Sandra Perez. She's interested in a lot of different educational paths right now, perhaps a business degree, studying law, but she's got a lot of time to figure it out. She'll spend the summer working, hanging out with family and friends, and looks forward to looking for colleges to attend this coming fall. For Casey Currents, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
Influx of immigrants in rural communities. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith, sitting in for Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're going to travel a little for these next two stories, to Mexico, via Wisconsin. Across the country in rural America, one in two new arrivals is Latino, according to a recent study. Reporter Laurel Morales went to rural Wisconsin to find out what this means for the changing community there.
When Sadie Kaiser walks into a classroom at the Durand School District in West Central Wisconsin, a few faces light up. She's the English language coordinator, which means she helps children who speak little English navigate the classroom. Kaiser checks in on the preschoolers, who stand around a table building and smashing things made out of Legos. She calls over one boy who speaks mostly Spanish.
¿Puedes decirle los ABCs?
Kaiser says for a child who speaks only Spanish, the first days at school can be painful.
Okay, how do we make sure this little guy can get to the bathroom when he needs to, whether it be teaching the teacher how to say, you know, keywords or pictures, you know, for the child to point.
Kaiser's position is fairly new. In the last few decades, the enrollment of Spanish-speaking children in schools here has grown. In Durand, the number has almost doubled in just the last 3 years. In the neighboring district, the Latino children now outnumber the rest of the students. Kaiser's job is to get to know the kids, and sometimes she winds up being an advocate for their families. She points to a child who comes up to her knee.
It's one of the families that's a little isolated. You know, they're out in the country. Mom stays home with the kids. Dad works in one vehicle.
Kaiser says that's pretty typical. She says the families keep to themselves, not only because they're isolated, but also because of the language barrier and because they stand out. Over the last 2 years, 1.5 million Latinos have moved into rural America, according to a study by Rural Family Economic Success Action Network.
I never dreamed that this little corner of the world would have this immigrant presence.
Sean Duvall serves as an interpreter for many dairy farmers and their workers. She says the newcomers here have changed the community, and not everyone knows how to handle it.
I mean, diversity is, if you're Norwegian growing up in a Swiss community, you know, that's diversity. And so they don't have any experience. And so it's not even so much discrimination, but just not knowing, really.
Sociologist Jill Harrison interviewed almost 300 immigrant dairy workers for her research on labor relations for the University of Wisconsin. About a third said they had experienced discrimination, and many felt they needed to keep a low profile. It's estimated that at least half of Wisconsin's dairy workers are in this country without legal documentation.
The aspect of my research that's really haunted me the most is just how incredibly vulnerable and scared the immigrant workers we interviewed really feel. They live in fear of being apprehended by law enforcement, which is an even much greater fear, I think, than their fear of being harassed.
Harrison's research shows these families' primary concern is being able to maintain their incomes and support their families. Alejandro De Pole supports a wife and two daughters back in Mexico. He says he came to Wisconsin to earn a decent paycheck so he could move his family ahead, nothing more. De Pole doesn't go out much, but the only time he's noticed discrimination is when some police pull a driver over because he's Latino.
La policía sí a veces discrimina cuando nos ve manejando.
Driving-related offenses are the most common reason Latinos appear in James Duval's courtroom. He's a judge for rural Buffalo and Pepin counties in western Wisconsin. Duval says some police officers are learning Spanish, but problems arise when a suspect and an officer can't communicate, like in this one recent incident.
It turned into a scuffle, which I felt was made worse because of the fact that the two couldn't really communicate very well.
Duval says the case went to trial where 8 out of 20 jury panelists said they couldn't be fair and impartial with a Latino defendant. Duval and others here say many in the community are resentful because the newcomers don't speak English, and that keeps the population separate. History tells us that the first wave of immigrants keep to themselves. It's their children who are more likely to integrate.
You're listening to a report from Laurel Morales of the Fronteras Desk, a collaboration of 7 public radio stations covering border issues. On her trip to Wisconsin, Morales came across John Rosenow, a fifth-generation dairy farmer. Times have changed since his Norwegian ancestors began farming in the town of Cochran. And Rosenow has changed with the times. Much of his workforce is now from Mexico, and Rosenow travels regularly to their village in southern Mexico to meet their families. Laurel Morales went to Rosenow's farm to check out this new binational dairy industry.
John Rosenow wakes up every morning at 3:30. He used to work almost 100 hours a week, but he says he's slowing down. Now he works closer to 80 hours, and it's not easy work.
I considered quitting, and then I thought of what I did during the day because I really wasn't making any money. Did I like what I did? And I really loved what I did.
Rosenow's business has grown. He and his workers now milk 550 cows 3 times a day. 8 out of 20 hired laborers are from Mexico. Family and neighbors make up the rest.
I've been called slave trader. I've been called somebody that runs an underground railroad and probably a whole lot of worse things behind my back. What I basically am is I'm a dairy farmer, trying to make a living in a difficult industry.
Rosenow actually pays fairly well, $27,000 to $40,000 a year. He also pays for health care and housing for all of his workers. We know from surveys, not all farmers treat their employees this well.
Hey, we got something for you to eat out here, huh?
The tall but gentle farmer tries to sweet-talk a new calf out of her hut. Rosenow guides me around the mud puddles to a semi-truck that he fills up with milk each day and sells to the cheese creamery across the street. In addition to dairy farming, he also has a profitable composting business. Rosenow scoops up a handful of what looks like rich black dirt.
We sell that to gardeners and landscapers. because of the rain, it's sopping wet right now.
When he started hiring workers from Mexico, Rosno decided to learn Spanish. His interpreter, Sean Duvall, suggested an immersion program in Mexico.
We had a meeting because we had the trip all arranged, and I said, is there anything else you'd like to do? And John said, well, I'd like to go and see where my employees are from. And I'm like, duh!
Since Rosno has gone down, 150 other Wisconsin dairy farmers have followed.
The employers realize that they owe these guys a lot more than just a paycheck, and so they become interested in their welfare and in their family's welfare. And they are extremely marginalized in these communities. They're some of the poorest places in all of Mexico.
It was quite a powerful experience to visit those people that are back there getting checks from their husband, usually working up here.
Without papers, most of these workers don't risk a visit home, so they often do not see their families for years.
Erasmo?
Sí.
Soy Lauren.
Erasmo has slept in after a late milking shift on Rosno's farm. He sits back in a recliner while others who share the kitchen come in and out while we talk. Erasmo points to a picture of his boss with his family in Veracruz. He didn't want us to use his last name.
Buena persona el patrón y bueno, yo lo respeto y él pues.
He says Rosno is a good person. I respect him. Each time Rosno goes back, he sees where the paychecks go. He has seen the standard of living in this village change. They go from dirt floors to concrete, from cooking over a fire to a gas stove. To push this process even further, he's given business classes to some of his workers who wish to use their paycheck to start a restaurant, bakery, or other business back in Mexico someday. Everybody on Rosno's farm comes from the same village. These days, when someone leaves, they send back a neighbor or cousin to take their place. Rosno's optimistic the latest proposals for immigration reform will pass, eventually allowing his workers to visit their families whenever they want or bring them safely to Wisconsin to be with them. I'm Laurel Morales, reporting in Wisconsin.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
A child doesn't end up in foster care without having experienced abuse or neglect. That alone can lead to lifelong problems. And many kids go from the foster care system into adulthood without the family support necessary to help them make their way in the world. Kansas Public Radio's health reporter Brian Thompson sat down with one young man who has overcome these challenges and now works for the Kansas foster care system.
I'm Daniel Martin. I myself was a foster youth. I came into the state's custody when I was 15 and aged out when I was 18. Before I was 15, my mom married my stepdad, who was an alcoholic and physically and emotionally abusive. That happened for a few years until a friend of the family from church had noticed bruises, on me from the abuse. They inquired about it. I couldn't lie to them because I'm not that creative, I guess. I couldn't come up with a reason why I had a bruise on my neck. And being 13 years old, you're just like, yes, sir. Told them what was going on. They made arrangements for me to stay there with them. And that kind of fell through, went back home and was living with my actual family. And it started up shortly thereafter.
Who got you into the system initially? Who reported you to the caseworkers?
Well, actually what had happened was my stepdad and I had had an altercation, I guess you'd call it. And I had left just because it was something that was better at the time. I'm just going to get out of the house so that it doesn't escalate even more. And had my cell phone and called my mom and let her know where I was at the time. And they had actually called in a runaway report with the police department here. So the police came and picked me up. They knew exactly where I was already anyways. And that's what initiated it all, even though I hadn't truly run away from home. Because they reported it as such, they took me to the children's home and then everything came to light there as the caseworker was talking to me.
When you were in foster care, how many different placements did you have?
There was at least three or four that I was at, which is pretty stable compared to other youth that are in the system. I was able to get into an independent living program here in Wichita and pretty much stayed there once I got there.
How does that work? Do they give you an apartment and you live truly independently by yourself?
The initial stages are pretty much a group home where there's a staff, and then you go through different life skill classes to actually make sure that you're ready to move into an apartment. And these are for youth that are usually ages 16, 17, or 18 to help transition them into being an adult. Then once you've completed the first stage, you move up to a apartment type setting, and there's still staff available there, and you have a case manager through the program. Usually from there, the next phase is truly your own apartment without the staff there, and that's usually about the time that you're going to transition out of custody anyways. Very good program.
So what did you experience then that made you want to come back and work with the system and improve it?
I was involved with the KYAC, the Kansas Youth Advisory Council, from the time that I was in foster care. It's something that we do because we want to make it better for youth that will come after us in the system. So it only felt natural when they offered me a position that was full-time with the state to actually help to improve the system even more so than what I may have been able to as a member of the KYAC.
So when you first started in this position, what did you want to accomplish? What did you want to change?
When I started in my position with the state, I wanted to help ensure that youth that were eligible for these independent living services that didn't know about them were informed and were able to utilize them like I was able to in order to help become a successful young adult that's just a normal person in society that goes to work, has an education, is able to contribute. I consider myself just a regular guy that goes to work, finishes up his degree, and going on to graduate school. All of that's something I never thought would have been possible when I was 15.
So what needs to be done to improve it?
We've come a long ways, actually. There's the foster care tuition waiver that youth that age out of foster care are eligible for to go to a public university within the state. Initially, the tuition waiver, for example, was not as inclusive as it is now. There was a cap on it as far as how many youth could actually partake of it and how much it paid and things like that. That's changed now. If you're eligible for it, you're eligible for it, and it's 100% pays the tuition and the fees. And that didn't used to be the case.
So if you could change anything about the system, what would you change?
I don't have anything that, you know, majorly that I would say to change other than ensuring that the youth that are in the foster care system know about these services and have a plan set up in place before they transition out, which is what we're currently working towards anyways. I'm proud to be a foster care alumni. It shows what I've been through, what I've overcome. Others out there that are in foster care right now should know that it might seem tough now, but it will get better. You will be able to go on and do whatever you put your mind to. There's nothing that'll stop you except for yourself.
That was Daniel Martin speaking with Kansas Public Radio's Brian Thompson. Having spent 4 years in foster care, Martin now works through the Department for Children and Families to help connect foster kids with the resources they need to make the transition to adulthood.
And now to the fight against methamphetamines. Many in the local law enforcement community think that people don't really understand the perils of manufacturing meth. KCOR's Dan Verbeck recently talked to a leader in the battle to combat an all-too-common drug.
Miniature meth labs have made the traditional big cooking operations almost obsolete around here. Sergeant Tim Witzig has seen the new garden variety grow since it surfaced in 2009.
In 2011, I think we had 28 meth labs of that sort. This last year we had 68. So they're well on their way.
Witzig heads the Metro Meth Task Force, operating out of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. Most of the work is in Missouri towns and cities. Evidence of this large number of small meth operations can be found discarded in city parks, empty lots, alleyways, or just about anywhere out in the country. Witzig describes the simple mixing in a 64-ounce plastic bottle of solvent, stripped-open lithium batteries, Phedrin cold medicine, and a capful of water. When shaken, he says, the power is awesomely dangerous.
So you're betting that it's not going to burst into flames solely upon a plastic soda bottle, okay? What has happened? That lithium strip hits water, instantly glows red, and gets fire hot, slaps to the side of the plastic bottle, and melts through the plastic bottle.
Witzig has seen the chemical reactions.
And watch a 8, 12-foot flame come shooting out of the side of that bottle. And this is what's being cooked in the basement or first floor of an apartment building.
Meth makers feel more secure, says Witzig, if different people carry separate ingredients before coming together to cook it, and it's hard to catch them.
How do we get to a point where we don't know where, when, or who, or how they're going to do it? That's TV stuff there. We don't have a script. So
you can't surveil.
How do I know the guy's going to be in this park at this time, at this place, doing that?
So detectives on the Metro Meth Squad track people they know have made it before and track a database that shows every legal pseudoephedrin sale in Missouri and hope they get lucky, because Witzig uses the word hideous to describe meth and what it does to a community. Education and treatment help, says Sergeant Witzig. He does see addicts who turn in other meth cookers.
It's not like digging a ditch and filling it back up, like with no hope. There's hope out there. It's there. It's a slow process.
Witzig emphasizes treatment and education.
Do I think that we are going to stop the meth lab scourge in 2013? Absolutely not. But we're going to do our end. We're going to carry our end of the log. And hopefully everyone else will do what they can do as well. Now, it's up to politicians and the people that have the money to allocate resources to get that done.
Sergeant Tim Witzig, leader of the Metro Meth Task Force. I'm Dan Verbeck, KCUR News.
It was only fitting that on a first Friday, the news came out. After 2 decades, one of the pioneers of the Crossroads Arts District would be closing his gallery. John O'Brien relocated the Dolphin to the West Bottoms 5 years ago. But now he says it's time for something new. KCUR's Laura Spencer has this look at the final show at the Dolphin.
It's late afternoon in the White Box Gallery of the Dolphin, a renovated industrial building in the West Bottoms. 16-year-old Caitlin O'Brien, with a long braid and wearing a plaid school uniform skirt, stands near a blank white wall stacking framed pictures. She holds a cell phone cupped in her hand, focusing on images and then looking up.
So I'm trying to zoom in and make sure it's the right one so that everything looks good and not I just kind of threw everything together.
She spent hours sifting through the Dolphin Gallery's deep inventory and asking artists to submit work for this final show. With some help from others, including her dad, owner John O'Brien, she selected more than 60 artists and almost 90 works of art, painting, sculpture, photography. The previous show was going to be the last show, but Caitlin argued that there should be one last opening.
I've grown up around the gallery and I've only missed one opening. And I didn't want to end on an opening that not everybody knew would be the last kind of celebration of the Dolphin. So I thought it would not only be important for all the people here, but also for myself to have just one last memory of a huge party here.
You know, the business model of the Dolphin is not just me. It definitely is a community, and we opened our doors up and let a lot of people participate in that model of what the Dolphin is about.
John O'Brien opened the Dolphin as a frame shop in Westport in the late 1980s. In the 1990s, he expanded it to include a gallery in what became known as the Crossroads Arts District. He moved to his current spot in the West Bottoms in 2008. O'Brien says for years he's been running three businesses at once, the gallery and frame shop, as well as doing design work for restaurants. He says he's ready for a change.
There's a wonderful sign on the outside of the building right now, David Ford's piece that says "We all die." And I learned so much from friends and artists, and I think it kind of sums up a lot of what all of us need to go through is we do all die, and what is really deep inside of us and how do we listen to that. And that's the moment in time that I'm in, kind of, is really listening very, very deep inside and asking really tough questions, and then asking a question, can I continue what I'm doing or do I need to pursue some other things?
When O'Brien announced the Dolphin would close, he also revealed he'd bought two industrial buildings in Independence, one to lease and one for his own projects. But he says he's gotten mixed responses, and he says he knows some people are hurt, including some of the more than 50 artists the Dolphin Gallery represents.
A lot of people are kind of a little confused what I'm doing, and I'm not sure what I'm doing either, other than I know that I have to do something different.
In the gallery, photographer Mike Sinclair chats with Caitlin O'Brien as she places artwork, commenting on drawings as if seeing old friends. Sinclair says the closing of the Dolphin is bittersweet.
For so long, it's the only place I've ever shown my work. I mean, it's where I started showing my work. I showed my work here first, and I've done three solo shows here, and I've shown my work very few other places. So it really is my artistic home.
One of Sinclair's photographs is included in the show. It was taken just after the mayor's State of the City address in March. There's a row of empty red chairs. Audience members are standing, some talking, some heading to the exit. Some are smiling, some are serious.
And when I was writing out the title, I thought, you know, and I wrote down State of the City, I thought, well, that's appropriate. That seems kind of appropriate for this show, because at least for the artistic community, it is kind of a reflection of the state of the city to have Dolphin closing.
Sinclair's photograph captures a moment in between, and some say that the arts community is now in that moment. With the Dolphin closing, Grand Arts closing in 2015, and Charlotte Street founder and co-director David Hughes stepping down. Again, John O'Brien.
I don't think it's been a tearing down, because there's a lot more here than when I started the Dolphin. And there's such a more vibrant community, and there's a lot of underground artist things that go on. And those are kind of where I think the power is kind of the things that are more underground. And I think everything kind of cycles around, and not just the arts, but I think it's a common kind of cleaning of house. And then being able to make room for new voices, I think, is so important. It is kind of, as Peter von Zegeder says, it's kind of a burning of a grass right now.
Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
The last exhibition at the Dolphin, called Thanks for the Warning, opened this weekend and runs through June 22nd. For photos and more information, check our website at kcur.org and click on Arts and Culture.
After the break, a new video from KCK native Janelle Monae. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Alex Smith. You've probably seen crime shows like CSI and America's Most Wanted, where artists work with victims to get a drawing that helps identify a criminal. This job is performed by a forensic illustrator. If you've seen one of these drawings on the news in Kansas City, then you've seen the work of artist and author Lee Hammond, who lives in Overland Park. As part of our Odd Job series, Casey Current's Suzanne Hogan met up with Hammond to look at how using memories, the face of a suspect or victim can come to shape.
A day can change quickly for artist Lee Hammond. She's been working on call for the Kansas City Police Department for over 30 years. She says you never know when you'll get the call to come in and help solve a case.
I take my little bag here that's got my drawing pencils and the things that I use for shading and erasers, and you know, I'll show up immediately.
Using these tools and facial identification books, which are filled with pages of examples of different physical characteristics, Lee sits down with victims or witnesses to try to turn a memory into a composite drawing.
Everybody thinks, oh, I couldn't describe my own mother. Well, you probably couldn't, but when you compare it to pictures, you know when it's right and you know when it's not right. And so through process of elimination, it almost gets exciting and fun, and they kind of forget what they went through, and it's like a whole different situation.
Lee's been doing this for a long time, and she says there's one major common misconception about this line of work.
People don't really understand what a composite is. They want it to be a portrait, and when they see the drawing and they see the mugshot of the person we've apprehended, you know, if it doesn't look identical to the guy, they think it wasn't a good composite.
A composite drawing is supposed to represent a grouping of facial characteristics to create a category that helps police officers narrow a search. Now, working as a forensic artist is only one small part of what Lee does for work. Inside her home studio in Overland Park, she works as an art teacher nearly every day of the week. Today, four women are chatting and working on paintings of their grandchildren or forest landscapes. It's a stark contrast from a crime investigation.
Oh, that was so much fun.
She shows student Susan Sinclair how to use a sponge to add details to a tree trunk.
Gives you texture without it.
Sinclair is a freelance artist for Hallmark and has been coming here for classes for over 10 years. But when she first signed up, she didn't know that Lee was painting more than animals, flowers, and celebrity portraits.
I didn't know about any of her other careers. Or the fact that she was in America's Most Wanted.
Lee's drawings have played a major role in solving local and national cases, much like some sort of superhero. She can transform quickly to answer the call.
I can feel myself changing from the person I am in this room that's kind of goofy and all over the place and having fun with my students. And I get called and I get in the car. And I can feel this change coming up over me where I'm straightening up and I'm getting more firm. And by the time I park my car and I walk in that police department, I'm a different person. So I morph into this forensic investigator, if you will.
Art has always been a part of Lee's life, but before she was an art teacher or did forensic art, she had hopes of going into law enforcement. She worked the late night shift for the Lincoln Police Department and was preparing for the academy. Sometimes she would bring in outside art projects to help pass the time during the long, boring shifts. Other officers there were also super bored, and while watching Lee draw, they decided to make up a game.
They would come in and they would pick out the ugliest people they could find out of their mug files and try to describe them to me. For some reason, it came easy to me, and I was like spot on, and it became, you know, draw the ugly mug shot every night.
And the practice from this game paid off in a very real way. One day, the day lieutenant called her in to do a composite for an abduction case.
I was just freaking out. I didn't know what to do.
But they figured Lee giving it a try was better than nothing, so she had a go at it.
I worked with her for about 5 hours, and we got a drawing. And the very next day, we apprehended him because the drawing looked so much like him that his own wife turned him in, saw the picture in the paper, and turned him in.
From that point on, they decided not to send Lee to the academy, but instead to Smith & Wesson Forensic Training. There, she learned about the facial anatomy of different races, interview techniques, how to make sketches after a body has started to decompose, age progression, and some psychology. It's a combination of art skills and people skills. Building a rapport is key to the process.
Especially with rape cases, or especially women, they're a lot more at ease with me than some, you know, 6'5" burly cop that's sitting there, you know, doing the interview. So they'll tell me things that they wouldn't tell someone like that.
Lee steps aside from the art class to show me a portfolio of drawings that represent cases she's been a part of.
This was a gentleman that was found dead floating in a creek, and no one could identify him. Well, there's the Alley Camp murder. This was Precious Doe. Do you remember Precious Doe?
Precious Doe, the pseudonym assigned to the unidentified body of a young girl who was found decapitated in Kansas City about 10 years ago. The case shocked the community with its brutality. Now, you can't put somebody's death photo on the news to identify them, so Lee worked with law enforcement to create a rendering of Doe so that the community could help in identifying her and find her killer. But the case took a toll on Lee.
I worked on Precious Doe for probably a week, and I remember my son, he said that after he'd gone to bed, if he got up, he could see my light on down in the living room, and he could hear me crying because it was that disturbing. And I never really got over that one.
Like any profession that deals with violence and trauma, it can have its emotional challenges in hand with the technical. With more and more departments using computer programs, finding someone like Lee who does composites by hand is becoming more rare. She says computer programs are better than nothing, but still believes that a personal, hands-on approach leads to more accurate results, which make the job that much more rewarding. Lee's accuracy record for identifying victims and suspects in cases is 100%. For KCUR News, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
This story first aired back in November. You can see a slideshow of composite drawings from forensic artist, teacher, and author Lee Hammond on our website at kcur.org.
And we're closing out today's show with a song recently released by KCK native Janelle Monae, featuring the neo-soul singer Erykah Badu. It was released as the soundtrack to a futuristic music video called Q-U-E-E-N. Badu, Monae, and the rest of the band play time-traveling rebels that have been caught and put on display in a living museum. The rebels are dressed in black and white, and they come to life in these robotic, jerky movements. Janelle Monae grew up in the Quindaro neighborhood of Kansas City, Kansas, and attended Schlegel High School. Later, she hit the music scene in New York, then Atlanta, working with rap artist Big Boy and Wonderland Productions. She's been called a female James Brown and is known for her gender-bending signature style. Her uniform, as she calls it, is a tight black and white tuxedo with bright red lipstick, geometric jewelry, and this big coiffed pompadour. Janelle Monae told our own Susan Wilson about it back in 2010.
I mean, when you see me with that attire on, I'm probably working, or I know that I'm working. And my job is, you know, again, as an artist, to empower other people. You know, this music is for the people, the performance, all of it is really to encourage them to dream greater and to imagine higher. And when I put on those clothes, it gives me the fuel that I need to continue to work.
The song Q-U-E-E-N will appear on Monae's album, The Electric Lady. It's a reference to Jimi Hendrix, Electric Ladyland. Q-U-E-E-N is actually an unexplained acronym, but Monae says it's based on private conversations she's had with Erykah Badu. Monae's really into science fiction, too. In fact, all of her albums follow the meta-narrative of the android Cindy Mayweather, Monae's muse. It might sound a little weird, but with this funky and fierce persona, Monae says she's making statements about unity, freedom, and self-empowerment.
Yeah. Yeah, let's flip it. She who writes the movie on the script and the sequel. So why ain't the stealing of my rights made illegal? They keep us underground working hard for the greedy. But when it's time to pay, they turn around and call us needy. My crown too heavy like the Queen Nefertiti. Give me back my pyramid, I'm trying to free Kansas City. Mixing master minds like you never.
streets because I'm willing and I'm able. Categorize me, I defy every label. And while you're selling dope, we gon' keep selling hope. We rising up now, you got a deal, you got to cope. Will you be electric sheep, electric ladies? Will you sleep or will you preach?
We've been listening to the song Q-U-E-E-N by KCK native Janelle Monae in collaboration with singer Erykah Badu. The song was released at the end of April and will appear on her upcoming album, The Electric Lady. See the video on our website, kcur.org.
Thanks for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia,
along with Alex,
and our intern, Monica Sandretsky. Theme music is by Approach. I'm Alex Smith. Susan Wilson will be back next week.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.